I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. This month, Kansas saw its U.S. Senator Pat Roberts announce his retirement and Laura Kelly sworn in as governor. And on the Missouri side, first-time governor Mike Parson is seeing what he can get done on workforce development and infrastructure. Today, a political panel mulls over the challenges that Kelly and Parson face and takes an early look at the Kansas City mayoral race. Then, 2020 will mark the 100th anniversary of baseball's Negro Leagues in Kansas City. To celebrate, 30 players will be memorialized as bobbleheads. We'll learn their legacy and how you can get your hands on the limited edition figures. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. There's been so much going on in the world of politics that we couldn't resist any longer. The Kansas City mayor's race is picking up steam. Missouri and Kansas are being led by new governors in their first legislative sessions. And there's lots of talk about an open U.S. Senate race in Kansas now that Pat Roberts has finally decided to hang it up. So let's talk about it. With us, Melinda Henneberger is my colleague on the Kansas City Star's editorial board. Welcome back. Good to have you.
Thank you so much.
Stephen Dial is a reporter with KSHB Channel 41. Stephen, nice to have you.
Good morning.
Joe Manis is a veteran Missouri political reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. Joe, always great to have you, too.
Hey, thanks for asking me.
Let's start by taking a look at Missouri, Joe, where Governor Mike Parson's at the helm for his first session as governor. He's talking about infrastructure, he's talking about workforce development, and he doesn't have a lot of money to do a whole lot of anything, given the tax cuts of recent years. What do you make of how he's doing so far, Joe?
Well, I think he's trying to do the best he can with kind of a bad deck of cards, so to speak.
Yeah.
He is not advocating any sort of tax hikes or anything like that, which some think tanks think need to be done. Others think we need to continue to be cutting taxes. He's proposing this $350 million bond issue to at least repair about 250 bridges around the state that are considered to be in really, really bad shape. And whether or not he's going to get the General Assembly to go along, I don't know. As you know, the voters in Missouri rejected a 10-cent a gallon increase in the state's gas tax, which is already one of the nation's lowest. I think he gets high marks for the way he deals with the General Assembly because he's a former lawmaker himself. He has great personal skills. He's been reaching out to Democratic mayors all over the state. So he gets high marks for his, I think, acumen and the way he handles himself. But he's faced with some serious money problems, and frankly, there isn't any way that he's going to be able to address some of the things he wants to do unless some changes are made.
Right.
And I don't think the lawmakers have any sort of appetite to make those kind of changes, and I don't think he does either.
You know, Melinda, saying that he's not Eric Greitens might be faint praise, or maybe it's something significant. How do you see it so far?
I think every day that he wakes up and is not Eric Greitens is a day that he wakes
That's
up ahead of
day.
The game.
Yeah.
And he, you know, my just first impression, he doesn't seem to be the kind of person who is motivated by, you know, gets up every day with the desire to make life worse for those already struggling. So that's a pleasant change as well. However, you know, talking about the infrastructure plan, when we had that piece today in the Kansas City Star saying on our editorial page, you know, 250 bridges to be replaced or repaired and not one is in Kansas City, not the Buck O'Neill Bridge. So that's problematic,
that's
of course,
issue.
From our perspective.
Yeah. You know, Stephen, he came to Kansas City last week, and one of his major stops, besides this program, was at a luncheon downtown to honor Mayor Kay Barnes. Now, the governor is a Republican. Kay Barnes is a well-known Democrat. What did you make of that?
Well, I think, as everyone said, I think he's trying to make sure that he's not Eric Greitens or anything similar to that.
Yeah.
You got the Democratic mayor of Kansas City, Sly James, who says, I like this guy. I don't care about our differences in party. I like the things that he's for. And so I think Governor Parson, as, you know, now a year down, but trying to just show that, you know, there will come times that he's going to just disagree with you. But I think he wants to give off that impression of, hey, at least I'm coming to the table to meet you halfway.
Right. You know, Joe, governors have the ability to pick any number of issues to focus on as they begin their terms. This governor, Mike Parson, is concentrating mostly on workforce development and infrastructure. As I said, why do you think he picked those issues?
Well, I think one key reason is that they're bipartisan. There's not much debate about either, about the need for either. I think he sees that as a way to reach out to the small Democratic cadre in the Missouri General Assembly, and also as a way to appease many of his fellow Republicans in the General Assembly, who, as we all know, couldn't stand Greitens for various reasons. And I think also he knows that this is a popular topic in rural Missouri, which is the right. Republican base in Missouri. And while he's trying to reach out to Democrats, if he has any hope for a re-election in 2020, it's obviously he's got to keep the rural base happy.
Right. He's also, Joe, he has this big budget shortfall that's looming out there. In some conversation about how legitimate that shortfall is it real or is it not? How concerned should taxpayers be about that?
Well, I think they should be. I've talked to Dan Hogg, the budget chief, a number of times. I wrote several stories about this several months ago. The bottom line is they thought they were going to have a shortfall during the last fiscal year, but during the last couple months, they had a windfall of money. That windfall of money, frankly, is helping to bankroll the current shortfall. So that's why there's not being calls for last-minute cuts or budget withholdings. They've got money to cover that. That money is eventually going to be spent. And unless they have a similar experience in the next couple months, they're going to be facing some hard choices this summer at the same time the governor's trying to propose some of this other stuff. So, no, it's very real, and it's probably going to get more dramatic because many of the tax cuts that have been passed the last 5 years, many of them had a delayed trigger date, mm-hmm. like 2 or 3 years down the road. Well, now it's 2 or 3 years down the road. So many of them are just starting to go into effect. And I think it is serious, but I'm not sure how they're going to be able to resolve it if they're committed to either cutting taxes more or making sure that they don't raise anything.
You know, Melinda, I can't help but note, and I think Joe just mentioned that one of his focal points is infrastructure. The governor's talking about fixing up bridges, but that doesn't say anything about all the highway miles that are out there. What do you make of what he's trying to do there? A good start or need to do more? How do you see it?
I think that there's such a need that not to include that is a little bit shocking. I mean, I'm sure it's true that there are many needs and not enough cash to cover even a portion of it, but I don't understand why that isn't on the agenda.
Yeah, doing the highways themselves.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
I asked him on the show last week, would he be open to the idea of going back to the voters again with a gas tax hike, with language that wasn't so confusing to a lot of voters, because the original ballot language in November talked about, hey, that money should be spent on the highway patrol, but that's not, he didn't seem show much interest in that.
Well, you know, we got 10 or 15 letters to the editor from voters at the paper saying, I would have voted for this had it been more clearly laid out.
Yes.
So I think, you know, it is something to think about going back to the voters again. Now, I know there's always hesitation to do that, overturning the voice of the people. Also, the outcome was not, it wasn't a close vote.
Mm-hmm.
But I just think that the need is so clear, they have to find a way to do it.
And voters need to have some buy-in here, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Stephen, is there any question in your mind that Governor Parson wants to seek the office himself in 2020? Does it look that way to you?
Oh, yeah. I think everyone knows and thinks that he wants to continue to be the governor of the state. You know, initially, you know, that was his aspirations before this whole lieutenant governor stuff. Just to piggyback really quick off of the gas tax, the governor kind of broke away from some people in his party as saying, we have the lowest gas tax in the country. We need to raise it if you want to fix roads and bridges. The language was outright confusing. And just talking to people about that, I think the governor was hoping that it passed because now the ball is in his court, really, to make tough decisions and possibly isolating some people because with the bridges, people in this area, if they don't see Buck O'Neill, they're like, hey, you've been here multiple times.
Yeah.
I thought we were building a relationship. but you're not giving us a new bridge. And so I think the tougher decisions for him will now come because that tax did not pass.
Yeah. Joe, before I say goodbye to you here, a Democrat from your side of the state, State Senator Scott Sifton, is looking at running against Mike Parson. Is he going to be the Democratic candidate? Is the party sort of going to get behind this guy? And just in a paragraph, who is he?
Well, okay, I know Sifton pretty well. We actually go to the same church. So, now he's a lawyer, pretty successful lawyer. He's been a leader in the state Senate among the small cadre of Democrats for several years. He often has led filibusters, you know, against right to work, for abortion rights. You know, I mean, he's got the progressive credentials. Now, but there's a question about whether or not he's got the charisma, he's got, you know, the vote-collecting power. I'm expecting there may be some other Democrats looking at it, but some of it's going to depend on how Parson, the power of Parson, let's say, by the later this year. Also, how things look in Washington, because a lot of Democrats feel that if Trump's fortunes improve, it's going to be hard for them to win anything statewide in Missouri. If the president's fortunes continue to be low, that maybe it'll give the state Democrats hope. And if that's the case, you'll see a lot more crowded candidate field for several offices. But I think it's too early to tell. But I don't think Sifton's going to be have a free lane for this. I think somebody will come forward, but I don't know who.
Well, that's the voice of Joe Manis again, a political reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. Joe, thanks for taking a few minutes. I sure appreciate it.
Hey, well, thanks for asking me. I appreciate it, too.
You bet. Well, let's flip over and continue our political panel here and talk about the race for Kansas City mayor. It's been a pretty low-key race so far, Melinda, but obviously, that's not going to last forever, is it? We're going to have some fireworks before too long.
It's a great field.
It's a great field. I agree with that.
I'm so impressed with a number of the candidates. I think that so I'm doing a series of little biographical pieces on each of the candidates, and there are a lot of them, 12.
All 12.
And I think the first piece that's running this week is on Alicia Kennedy. City council member, and I think she has got to be the most underestimated in the field. I find her so impressive as a person and as a public servant.
That's interesting.
This woman in high school, when school let out every day, would go work 8 hours doing bill collecting. And I said, so the person on the phone saying, please pay up, was 15 or 16 years old.
Wow.
Yes, that's what she
that's what she did.
Yes. She put herself through college as a nail tech with her own business. It took her 9 years. Then she went on. She sold real estate for a while. She was one of three African-Americans at her law school in South Dakota. And she's a person who's not afraid to stand up and take an unpopular stand.
I was going to say, last week, she voted against the renaming of the Paseo for Martin Luther King Jr., and that, I know, antagonized a lot of the black clergy members who led that crusade.
Well, that's her district, District 5, a big portion of it. And she said that the people were never asked. Her constituents were never polled on this. And she was representing them, and they didn't want the thing renamed. So, you know, it sounds like, well, of course you would want to rename something for Martin Luther King Jr. But her point was that who does it help if it's something that was so opposed by her constituents? I think the other thing is that she has lagged in terms of fundraising, and I think that we often overestimate the importance of money. We kind of see that as a stand-in for the polling that doesn't always happen. But, you know, she is the candidate who is running against goodies for rich developers. Mm-hmm. So perhaps it shouldn't be so surprising that her coffers are not full.
Stephen Dial, does this race have a front runner?
You just mentioned polling. With the lack of polling, it's kind of just who seems like they're more known by name recognition already.
Well, name ID is a big factor.
Name ID is big. Name ID is big, but a lot of people can't even name all the council members who are running for mayor. I think the I would say Quentin Lucas is just a front runner in my opinion, but I will also say that Martin Luther King debate, that back and forth, it got kind of nasty. I think that definitely probably readjusted some people's scales and what they may have thought of, you know, Mayor Pro Tem Scott Wagner and him opposing it. Kennedy, who opposed it, who's also black and, you know, wants to get the black vote. You know, some people from her opinion saying that people in her district weren't even for renaming the street. And so I think if there isn't polling, but I think the Martin Luther King debate kind of shifted whatever polling or whatever ranking there may have been.
And just I want to note, the Kraske Power Rankings out last week in my column mentioned Jolie Justice as sort of the undisputed front runner at this point. Others would disagree mm-hmm. with that, but that's at least how I saw it. Is she up there in your view, Melinda?
See, I think it is difficult to say who the front runner is at this point.
Right.
So you were bold to do that, Steve. The other thing about this race, though, that I just want to mention is what a love poem it is to the single African-American mom. I mean, three people in this race had a very similar background, and they are leading the city today, and they're all contenders to become the next mayor. I think, you know, all two of them went through periods of homelessness as children.
Yes.
I mean, just overcame amazing odds.
Quentin Lucas,
so
Jermaine
Quentin
Reed,
Lucas
you're
and
Jermaine to.
Reed
yeah.
being the other two with Alicia Kennedy.
Steven.
Really quick, just watch out for Phil Glenn. He's not a huge name, but
I agree.
Every
right.
time that
I
there's a mayoral
well.
Forum and he speaks, if any of a reporter from my station, when they talk to voters after, they say, I didn't know that Phil Glenn guy, but I kind of liked what he said.
Yes.
And I think if his voice gets louder and louder, he could be inching towards that final two.
That's interesting. There are 12 candidates in the field, Melinda. I mean, voters are going to have to spend some time sorting this out, as we are at the newspaper and you are at Channel 41. I mean, there's a lot of people, a lot of things to think about here.
Yes, I would say there are eight real contenders in the race, and that's pretty amazing in itself.
Yeah.
So, you know, the things that we on the editorial board have talked about a lot as being things that we ought to look at is who has a plan on affordable housing, which is increasing an issue in the city.
Right.
Who has a plan on how to deal with violent crime?
Absolutely.
So those two things, more than anything else, I think are issues to look at.
Okay, let's hop over the state line for a moment and turn to Kansas and the new governor there, Laura Kelly. She's already encountering some intense opposition from Republicans who want to push a tax cut and aren't showing all that much interest in fixing schools, even though that seemed to be almost a done deal after last year. Stephen, what do you make of it? Because I guess I've been surprised by just how determined Republicans seem to be so early on here.
Well, I kind of mentioned this maybe a week or two ago. I think it's a matter of seeing what will the Republican stronghold leadership kind of bend and give her. I, in my opinion, don't think that they will let a Democratic governor get a win on something as huge as funding education. But it's a matter of how willing is the governor going to be in saying, okay, let me get this and I'll work on you with this.
Right.
And as you can see, Susan Wagland, all these people are already saying, look, we're not just going to make this a cakewalk for her. And so I think it's just a matter of what will the Republicans say? Okay, we'll let her take credit for this if we can get this.
Yeah. We have a tweet here from Leslie based on what she's seeing in Kansas. Perhaps the largest issue in Kansas is legislature is ready unwillingness and intransigence even when approaching Governor Kelly. It's going to take time to change the culture and habituate to real engagement. Dan Hawkins, one of the Republican leaders over there, his knee-jerk response to expanding CanCare offered as Exhibit 1. Governor Kelly's up against a lot, Melinda.
She is, particularly on Medicaid expansion, which I think, you know, the voters made clear they want Medicaid expanded. The legislature now is more conservative than when they passed it. And thank you again, former Governor Brownback, for nothing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's to me, the most important thing that Kansas faces, that, you know, we're talking about maybe reforming the sentencing and the prison system. You cannot do that without providing treatment for people and you can't get treatment unless you expand Medicaid. This would help the state in every way. And your column a couple of weeks ago on Susan Weigel wanting to run for the Senate and maybe some of her unwillingness to bend, at least, you know, so far what we've seen, you know, is back to she doesn't want primary voters in Kansas to see that she actually worked with Democrats to accomplish something for the state.
She wants to cut taxes at the same time she wants to launch a bid for the U.S. Senate.
Yes.
Perhaps those two things go hand in hand. Well, her governor's Kelly's priority, Stephen, schools, vulnerable kids, helping them, expanding Medicaid. Is she going to get all that done this session?
I mean, it's a lofty goal, and why not shoot for the stars this session? I don't think so.
Yeah. Okay, let's turn to the U.S. Senate. Senator Pat Roberts, who was first elected to Congress in 1980, announced this month that he's not going to seek re-election in 2020. A big surprise there, Melinda, or not really?
I don't think it was a surprise, and I'm sure he listened to our editorial board before making that decision.
Don't do it, Pat. Yeah.
But what an interesting, you know, once-in-a-generation opportunity. So it's not a surprise either that you see so many people eyeing it. A pleasant surprise, though perhaps it shouldn't have been, was to see the Kansas Republicans trying to send as clear a signal as possible to Kris Kobach that they never wanted to see the phrase GOP nominee Kris Kobach ever again.
It's an astonishing thing to have party leaders standing up already saying they don't want Kris Kobach anywhere near this race.
Right, because of the disorganization and lack of fundraising that happened in the last race. Trying to rally around Mike Pompeo, who would definitely be a strong candidate. And I thought it was so interesting when Pompeo sort of left the door open, but said, you know, he seemed to be perhaps mollifying his current boss by saying, no, don't worry, I'm here as long as I'm here.
Well, Stephen, what Melinda Henneberger is saying is that the Secretary of State of the United States of America might be looking at a run for the U.S. Senate in Kansas, and some people might conclude, well, that's kind of a step down.
Right.
He's in, what, fourth in line in the succession to be the next president. Why would Mike Pompeo take a look at running for the U.S. Senate if that's a possibility?
If that's a possibility is the key word. But I think, one, because of party loyalty, and in my opinion, I think the Republican Party of Kansas, if his name is on the ballot, I think that will knock out more than just a Kris Kobach. It will probably make some other people say, let me think about if Jerry Moran will not run for re-election down the road. I think his popularity nationwide and in the state that he wants represented will go a long way. And so I think if he runs, I think it would be out of party loyalty and not so much of a power grab of this is a technically a lower position on the scale of hierarchy. But it'd be interesting.
But he sort of stalls the race in the sense that he is so well known and could raise money so quickly. He doesn't have to jump into the race until even next year, which might freeze the entire field. Who's going to get in knowing that Pompeo, the 10,000-pound giant out there, might jump in?
And I think a lot of people are still looking at, you know, there's been a lot of conversations. Every time someone asks me this question, I still mention Jeff Collier, former governor of Kansas. I think he's interested, but I think he's also like, let me see. I don't want to just jump in just to jump in.
Every day that's delayed is a good day for Democrats, as long as their odds are.
The Democrat in this race, Barry Grissom, former U.S. attorney for Kansas. There could be others as well. It's been since the 1930s that a Democrat has won a U.S. Senate seat in Kansas. That's the longest streak in the entire nation. Why is it so hard for Democrats to win in Kansas? Why a streak that long?
It defies what I can explain, honestly. But I was looking, you know, Al Capone went to prison the last year a Democrat won a Senate seat in Kansas.
Boy, that's amazing. Well, other names on the Republican side, you mentioned Jeff Collier, Stephen, the former governor. There's the 1st District Congressman, Roger Marshall. And he's interesting only because 1st District congressmen have traditionally won these Senate seats. Pat Roberts is a former Western District congressman. So is Jerry Moran. Then there's the Attorney General, Derek Schmidt, out there. So it's a long possible list here.
It's a lot. And then Jake LaTourneur, the state treasurer.
I forgot to mention him.
And
yeah,
he officially announced, and I sat down with him and I asked him, I said, hey, man, there's a lot of people running. And then I asked him the question that a lot of people asked with Josh Hawley of the Climb and the Ladder. He's only been the treasurer for about a year and a half. I said, you're jumping from treasurer to now running for the Senate. And he believes that he looked at this past election and saw that a lot of people voice wanted younger, and he says, I'm the youngest person statewide elected official in the country. People want young, people want fresh new leadership. I wonder if that'll spin in his favor with, I mean, if you looked at the last election, it went young.
Maybe yeah. Some of those excellent high school students who ran for governor.
Right.
And maybe they'll run too. There you go. Well, I want to thank our very good panelists here, Stephen Dial with KSHB Channel 41 and Melinda Henneberger, my colleague on the Kansas City Star's editorial board. Thanks for a good conversation. Appreciate it very much.
Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about Negro National League bobblehead. Satchel Paige coming to a bobblehead near you. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Last week, Missouri Governor Mike Parson shared details of his plans for infrastructure and workforce development that we just talked about in our first segment today. You can hear that conversation and others at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, we ask one businessman how he stands out in the race for Kansas City mayor. Henry Klein tells us about the issues he looks to address if elected. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, late last year, organizers of the Negro National League announced they were setting out to commemorate some of the league's best players with a series of What Else special bobbleheads, a Kickstarter campaign launched by the National Bobblehead Hall of Fame and Museum, and the organization Dreams Fulfilled set out to raise $10,000 in a Kickstarter campaign by January 7th to make this happen. They made that in the first day, and then over $50,000 when it was all said and done. Kansas City Monarchs pitcher Satchel Paige was one of the first to be produced, and the next batch will be ready for release by mid-March. With us today are Bob Kendrick. He's president of the Negro League Baseball Museum. Bob, welcome back. Always good to have you here.
Steve, great to see you, man. Thanks for having me.
Jay Codwell of Kirkland, Washington is the founder of Dreams Fulfilled. He joins us today via Skype. Jay, good morning to you.
Well, good morning to you. Glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Bob, why bobbleheads to honor some of baseball's greats? I mean, why not, right?
Yeah, because bobbleheads have been such a pertinent part of baseball history. And as Jay will attest, because really it was his idea to do this series, a historic series, that the Negro Leagues had not had that same kind of representation that other major league figures had. And what an opportunity to educate through collectibles.
Really good point. Jay, what got you thinking about the Negro League stars and bobbleheads?
Well, always have been interested in baseball and just felt the Negro Leagues were underrepresented. And I had done an art show with Bob at the last Kansas City Major League Baseball All-Star Game. And as the centennial was coming up, I just thought it was another great opportunity to promote the players, promote the Negro Leagues, and Bob's Museum.
You know, Bob, I don't want to make too much of this, but there is something to be said in our culture for when you memorialize somebody on a bobblehead, it does sort of give them a certain cachet. It makes the whole thing come alive somehow.
It does. And I hearken back to when we did the first Buck O'Neill bobblehead when he was still with us at that time. And Steve, now here's a man who had done virtually everything you could possibly do in his 70 plus years in baseball. But I think seeing himself depicted as a bobblehead was his finest moment. You know?
What does that say about us?
You know? I guess when you become a bobblehead, you have made it. It is official at that point.
That's all there is to everything. Yeah. So this Kickstarter, Jay, was launched by the National Bobblehead Hall of Fame and Museum. I didn't know there was such a thing. And Dreams Fulfilled. But it's licensed by the Negro League Baseball Museum. Your goal was to raise $10,000. Were you wondering at first if you'd be able to meet that goal?
We were. We had no idea whether this would succeed or not, and just were incredibly surprised as we started seeing the donations roll in.
Because you raised $50,000 for bobbleheads.
Yeah, it was more than that. It ended up being almost $80,000. So we were just delighted.
You must have just about fallen over.
Yeah. Well, we did. It was just a wonderful, wonderful contribution, and people really like the concept of what we're doing.
Why do you think, Jay, there was ultimately so much enthusiasm for this? Is it the collector's item aspect of this, or what is it that drove this level of enthusiasm?
I think there's several things. It's part of it is collectibles. Part of it is we've really tried to play up the historical importance of these players in the leagues and tied it into various civil rights issues. And I think that resonated with people.
Give us some background on your Dreams Fulfilled organization, Jay. What is it? What are you aiming to do?
Well, I formed it purely to support the centennial of the founding of the Negro National League. And worked with Bob, and Bob is planning, I'm sure, all kinds of activities around the centennial. But my involvement will be in the Art and Artifact exhibit, which will run from February 1st to May 31st, 2020. And I'm contributing 300 original pieces of art and 100 artifacts.
Wow.
So yeah. I'm just kind of focused on this. That was what my company was for. And hopefully we'll see a very great exhibit and celebration.
Yeah, no, it's going to be spectacular. And Steve, I wanted to mention for those who I know they've heard us say centennial, the actual centennial, 100 years since the birth of the Negro Leagues, is next year, 2020.
Yes.
With the leagues having been formed here in Kansas City in 1920.
Right down there on the Paseo and 18th Street,
absolutely,
roughly, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. At the old Paseo YMCA. The future Buck O'Neill Education and Research Center. And so we certainly believe that a centennial celebration is a tremendous milestone occasion. You know, we as not-for-profits are always looking for an anniversary we can hang our hat on.
And you've got a big one here.
And we've got a legitimate and a big one. And so this is part of what is going to be a tremendous celebration.
How are you going to commemorate the 100th anniversary? Let's talk about that for a
moment.
Yeah,
no, we're sitting down right now trying to map out what we believe, Steve, will be a national celebration, because Kansas City is the birthplace, but there were so many cities that were greatly impacted by the Negro Leagues. And we see this as an opportunity to raise heightened awareness for the museum, but also to raise much needed funding for the museum. And so the work that Jay is doing as a licensee will help generate revenue for the museum. So a portion of the proceeds from every one of those bobbleheads sold will come back in support of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. And so this is a very teachable opportunity for us, we think, from a branding standpoint, and then from a fundraising standpoint, this may be one of the most significant opportunities really in recent museum history.
You know, Bob, take us inside that building at 18th and the Paseo 100 yes. years ago next yeah. year. What happened that day? And tell us a little bit about who Rube Foster was.
Yeah, and you just mentioned the man, Andrew okay. Rube Foster, who I think you can make a legitimate case may be the most important person in baseball history for what he did in creating the Negro Leagues. And those meetings took place there at the Paseo YMCA. Rube Foster convened a meeting with 8 independent black baseball team owners. They came into Kansas City, met at the old Paseo YMCA.
Was Kansas City one of those teams?
Kansas City Monarchs were one of the chartered mm-hmm. members of those 8 original teams. And out of that meeting came the birth of the Negro National League, the first successful organized black baseball league. Steve, those leagues would then go on to operate amazingly for 40 years from 1920 until 1960. It would not only change our game, but those leagues helped change our country. And I think that's what Jay referenced when he talked no about question. A civil rights story. So the story of the Negro Leagues is so profound. It is so much bigger than the game of baseball, even though it's just a tiny part of the great story of the game of baseball.
Well, why was there even a need for a Negro League at that time? What was the driving force there? Why did we need to have one?
Segregation.
Because Major League Baseball was all white.
It was all white. And at one point in time, Major League Baseball might accept white Cubans. But if you were of any other skin color or any other ethnicity, you couldn't play. And so all of these mega talented athletes, African-American and Hispanic baseball players, had no real place to showcase their world-class baseball abilities. And so there's been black baseball been played well before 1920. But it was so haphazard. You know, you had guys jumping from teams to teams, booking agents were taking all the money. And then Rube Foster brought the vision. Yeah, he brought the vision and the know-how to establish a real successful organized baseball league. And these leagues just took off. And it gave us some amazing talent that nobody really knew anything about. I think they look at baseball from 1947 on. Yeah, and then when we talk about people of color playing this game after Jackie Robinson. But Steve, I can tell you now, they were playing great baseball well before Jackie Robinson.
Absolutely. What was Rube Foster's biggest challenge to get this thing off the ground? Was it money?
I think money was always part of the challenge. And the thing about the Negro Leagues, they weren't as well financed as the Major Leagues, but the talent was every bit as good as Major League Baseball. And of course, trying to identify stadiums, because they didn't have, you only had a handful of Negro League owners that eventually owned stadiums. So you needed to have access to stadiums and those kinds of things as well to put together your league schedule. So you'll hear people say, well, their schedule wasn't organized. No, that's not true. It took a minute because they had to wait for the Major League schedule to get in place before they could then see when they could get access to some of those stadiums to put their schedule together. Yeah.
And the Negro Leagues played in Kansas City where?
22nd in Brooklyn. Yes. Old Muehlbach Field.
That's right.
Some will remember it as Municipal Stadium, home to the great Kansas City Monarchs. And I tell the story all the time. Opening day here in Kansas City for the Monarchs, there would be a parade that would start at 18th and Vine to go up to 22nd in Brooklyn. And behind them, 17,000 plus standing room only to see the great Kansas City Monarchs play. The Monarchs, many will say, were the New York Yankees of the Negro Leagues, but there are others who will say that the New York Yankees were the Kansas City Monarchs of the Major Leagues. Wow. They were that good.
Wow. And boy, it'd be fun to go back in time and take that walk, wouldn't it?
I think that's a good idea. We may need to recreate that experience again.
Well, why not?
Yeah.
I mean, it'd be a great idea. It'd be a great idea. Well, Jay, going back to the bobbleheads, you know, contributions of, what, $20 or more was said to give better pricing and first dibs on the bobbleheads. How many of each bobblehead is going to be produced here? How many people are going to get first dibs on them?
Well, it's going to vary by player, but we're producing 2,020 of each one to commemorate the centennial, as the centennial. And then depending on what the people selected, I think Satchel Paige is the most popular one.
Paige, yeah.
I think in the initial contributions, I think something like 600 people signed up for him. And we'll just have to see how it goes from there.
Remind us who Satchel Paige was, as if some of our listeners undoubtedly know him, Jay, but who was he?
Well, as a baseball player, he was, you know, the finest pitcher of the Negro Leagues and arguably the finest pitcher of all time. But I think one of the aspects of his life that gets often overlooked is his personality was so big and he was so quick with a quip. It was his popularity that really brought the Negro Leagues to the attention of white newspapers. And it was really Satchel Paige through his efforts with various tournaments and exhibitions that paved the way for eventual integration.
Bob, what was that pitch that Satchel Paige had that was so famous? The Dipsy Doodle?
He had a bunch of them.
Everyone had a name, right?
He had a name for all of his pitches. So he had the Midnight Creeper. He had the Two-Humper, the Bat Dodger, the Hesitation Pitch. He had the Long Tom, the Short Tom, the Jump Ball, the Trouble Ball, the Radio Ball, the Wobbly Ball, the Dipsy Doo. And Steve, he had a pitch that he called the B-Ball. And you know why he called it the B-ball?
I do not.
Because Satchel says it bees where I want it to be when I want it to be there. I tell people all the time, if Satchel was playing today in this age of social media,
right,
he would be the biggest star on the face of the planet. He had that kind of charisma.
You know, when he finally retired, and I underlined the word finally because he pitched a long time, but he retired here to Kansas City, right?
Yes. Yeah. Lived and died
Spent
here
his final
in Kansas
years.
City. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Where did he live?
He lived over just off of in between Prospect and Benton, almost on Victor, about 26 and... You know, the house just recently was burned in May of last year.
Is that right?
Set fire arson. And then a month later, the Buck O'Neill Center was damaged by vandals with water, who cut a waterline pipe and flooded the building. So the two most iconic names in Black baseball history, particularly as it relates here in Kansas City, both had something damaged by folks that bared their name. Now, again, I'm going to venture to guess that whoever committed the arson to Satchel's home
had no idea.
They had no idea that it was Satchel's home.
There should be a little plaque or a monument or something out there commemorating where Satchel lived.
We still have hopes that that home can be restored. And I know that there are still plans on the back burner to try and restore Satchel's house, because the house was just majestic. It was so befitting of an athlete of the magnitude of Satchel Paige. And I do hope that there's something that can be done to save that, or, as you say, at the very least, be able to designate it as the site of the home of Satchel Paige.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking about a series of Negro Leagues bobbleheads that are being produced to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Negro Leagues right here in Kansas City 100 years ago next year. To what extent, Jay, are these things going to become collector's items and people are going to be buying the entire set? What kind of interest are you seeing down that road already?
Well, we are seeing some interest in people buying the entire set. It's beginning to take off. I think the limitation on buying the whole set is that there's 32 of them. Mm. And so that causes a bit of a hesitation. But because they're so limited in quantity compared to a stadium giveaway, I think they're going to become quite nice collectibles.
So if people are interested, where can they go to get them and how much do they cost?
Okay, they cost $30 a piece. You can go, Bob is carrying him at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum.
I got to come down and get the satchel. Yeah. Yeah.
I am selling them on my website, which is NegroLeaguesHistory.com. The Bobblehead Hall of Fame is selling them, which is BobbleheadHall.com.
Where is the Bobblehead Hall of Fame, Jay?
It is in Madison, Wisconsin.
Do you know very much about, you know, where these, why bobbleheads came to begin with?
The origin of it, I do not know.
Because it's got to be a story there somewhere.
There has to be. Yeah, they started, as I recall, in the late 1950s, was when the first ones appeared that I'm aware of.
Yeah. Okay, but it's in Madison.
I don't know this art.
Yeah, okay.
Madison, Wisconsin. Yep.
Because we know that some rare bobbleheads go for a whole lot of money, like over $1,000.
Right, right.
Okay. So the first bobbleheads were like paper mache, ceramic, generic, and Roberto Clemente had a bobblehead at one
absolutely.
Point, Bob, Mickey Mantle, Roger Maris, yes. Willie Mays. Do you have some of those at the Negro Leagues?
We don't have those, but we started with bobbleheads of Buck. And then we eventually did a bobblehead of Satchel Paige. Mm-hmm. And the bobblehead that we did of Satchel, if you ever saw the film Are We There Yet, starring Ice Cube, the bobblehead was like the confidant, and the bobblehead was the actual Satchel Paige bobblehead that we had done. They asked permission to use it in the film, and of course it was a featured part of the film. And now we've kind of started doing bobbleheads. We do a series now called the Monarchs Legacy Series, and it actually depicts former Kansas City Royals in the uniforms of Kansas City Monarchs.
Oh, that's interesting.
So the first release was Frank White. The second release was Amos Otis. And most recently, Willie Wilson wearing a 1924 Kansas City Monarch uniform. And it's symbolic of the way it would have been had they been born 70 years later. They would have been playing for the Kansas City Monarchs, and that they embodied that style of play that was so signature to Negro Leagues. And so we've sold these through the Hy-Vee stores, and Hy-Vee's been generous enough to donate all the proceeds back to the museum. And so we're seeing this collectible aspect of this business really start to take off. And I do think that fans are gaining an appreciation, a much larger and greater appreciation for the history of the Negro Leagues and the great stars of the Negro Leagues. And I certainly hope that the Negro Leagues Museum has had a hand in helping create this greater interest.
Jay, you guys are looking to release two a month through February 2020, 32 in all, with five special additional bobbleheads. Tell us about these five special bobbleheads.
Well, they were what they call rewards for reaching successive higher levels in the Kickstarter campaign. So we're very excited that those proved successful and people really wanted them. But the five additional ones will be Effa Manley, who is the owner of the Newark Eagles and the only woman in the Baseball Hall of Fame. Pete Hill in a Milwaukee Bears uniform, which is a team that played for one season only. And then we're going to be doing Satchel Paige, Cool Papa Bell, and Josh Gibson, all in the uniforms of the 1937 Dragones de Ciudad Trujillo, which was a Dominican Republican team that was quite an interesting story.
I understand a portion of these proceeds are going to the players themselves. Jay, do I have that right?
That's correct. We worked hard on finding as many of the estates as we possibly could and signed contracts with the estates, and they're donating a portion of proceeds to every estate we could find.
You know, the notion that there's a connection between the Negro Leagues and these players and civil rights, Bob, you've already made that connection. Tell us a little bit more about that in the 45 seconds I got here.
Well, you know, I think every time they went to the plate, they were taking a swing for equality. But then when you fast forward and you learn that Jackie Robinson was handpicked from the great Kansas City Monarchs to break baseball's six-decade-long self-imposed color barrier. And the museum makes the assertion that Robinson's breaking of the color barrier wasn't just a part of the civil rights movement, it was the beginning of the civil rights movement.
Wow.
1947, wow. Before Brown versus the Board of Education, before Rosa Parks' refusal to move to the back of the bus.
Right.
As old Buck would say, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was a sophomore at Morehouse College when Robinson signed that contract. President Truman would not integrate the armed forces until a year after Jackie. So that's really what started the ball of social progress rolling in our country.
And that's baseball. An amazing story, isn't it?
It really
so
is.
So important to our history.
Absolutely it is.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm going to thank you both for taking some time to explain this phenomenon of Negro Leagues bobbleheads to us. You just heard the voice of Bob Kendrick, president of the Negro League Baseball Museum. We were also joined by Jay Caldwell of Kirkland, Washington, the founder of Dreams Fulfilled. He joined us by Skype today. Gentlemen, thank you both very much. Sure appreciate it.
Absolutely, Steve. Anytime.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thanks, Jay.
Thank you
bet.
For having me.
Last week on the show, former Kansas Congressman Kevin Yoder discussed his 8 years in Washington and whether he might run again for office. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, a discussion on what's attracting more minority families to predominantly white suburbs and the problems they face. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.